Normally I talk about climate change in the Gulf of Maine and ways that we adapt to it, and I'm going to talk about that, but I'm going to start off with kind of like an overview of the tiny giants and the ocean microbiome, which is what we study at Bigelow, and how that connects to the images and also just why we study it and what it is. The scientists might know what the ocean microbiome is, many of the artists might too, but many people might not. So I'm going to start with kind of introducing that idea. So this is a diagram of the ocean microbiome done by my daughter when she was four. She's only 5 now. I thought at the time we were trying to come up with a new logo for Bigelow, and I'm like, how about this? They might get this nice watermark instead. Anyway, to understand what the ocean microbiome is, I think it's actually helpful to understand the human microbiome. And you might have heard about this in the news, NPR, that sort of thing. It's a pretty new and exploding area of knowledge that we have. And the way to think about it is a human being is not just an individual organism. For a long time, we've thought a human is a human, that's what it is. A dog is a dog, and so on. And with the discovery of the human microbiome, we know that's not the case. Actually, most of the cells in your body are non-human. They're bacteria. There are all kinds of different species of bacteria, something called archaea, fungi, yeast, things like that. There's myriads of viruses throughout your body, whether you're sick or not. There's actually probably 2 or 3 different species of arachnids living on your face, and they each have their own microbiomes too. And the purpose isn't to freak you out, but this perspective has just sort of changed how we view the human experience. I mean, you think about art giving us new ways to view the human experience. This is a way that science has taken a new lens on what it means to be human. And it turns out that this microbiome, this ecosystem of organisms living in and on the surface and around our bodies all the time, interacts with the human cells as well, and it affects our health, our mood, our development, our brain development. There's something that they call the gut-brain axis, I think, which is like the communication that happens between your gut microbiome and your brain development and your brain, how it responds to different changes in your body. A lot of this research is like really bleeding edge, so it's, some of it's on mice and we don't know if it applies to humans, but it could have to do with human longevity, energy levels, weight loss. I mean, there's a whole kind of pseudoscience that has spun off with it as well, but in terms of the science, it's really integral to how our whole body functions, from our health to our personality to our heredity. A lot of aspects of heredity may be tied to the microbiome as well. So anyway, that's the human microbiome. And it's the research on that is just exploding for largely for like medical research and that sort of thing. Normally I talk about climate change in the Gulf of Maine and ways that we adapt to it, and I'm going to talk about that, but I'm going to start off with kind of like an overview of the tiny giants and the ocean microbiome, which is what we study at Bigelow, and how that connects to the images and also just why we study it and what it is. The scientists might know what the ocean microbiome is, many of the artists might too, but many people might not. So I'm going to start with kind of introducing that idea. So this is a diagram of the ocean microbiome done by my daughter when she was 4. She's only 5 now. I thought at the time we were trying to come up with a new logo for Bigelow, and I'm like, how about this? They went with this nice watermark instead. Anyway, to understand what the ocean microbiome is, I think it's actually helpful to understand the human microbiome. And you might have heard about this in the news, NPR, that sort of thing. It's a pretty new and exploding area of knowledge that we have. And the way to think about it is a human being is not just an individual organism. For a long time, we've thought a human is a human, that's what it is. A dog is a dog, and so on. And with the discovery of the human microbiome, we know that's not the case. Actually, most of the cells in your body are non-human. They're bacteria. There are all kinds of different species of bacteria, something called archaea, fungi, yeast, things like that. There's myriads of viruses throughout your body, whether you're sick or not. There's actually probably 2 or 3 different species of arachnids living on your face, and they each have their own microbiomes too. And the purpose isn't to freak you out, but this perspective has just sort of changed how we view the human experience. I mean, you think about art giving us new ways to view the human experience. This is a way that science has taken a new lens on what it means to be human. And it turns out that this microbiome, this ecosystem of organisms living in and on the surface and around our bodies all the time, interacts with the human cells as well, and it affects our health, our mood, our development, our brain development. There's something that they call the gut-brain axis, I think, which is like the communication that happens between your gut microbiome and your brain development and your brain, how it responds to different changes in your body. A lot of this research is like really bleeding edge, so it's, you know, some of it's on mice and we don't know if it applies to humans, but it could have to do with human longevity, energy levels, weight loss. I mean, there's a whole kind of pseudoscience that has spun off with it as well, but in terms of the science, it's really integral to how our whole body functions, from our health to our personality to our heredity. A lot of aspects of heredity may be tied to the microbiome as well. So anyway, that's the human microbiome, and it's you know, the research on that is just exploding for largely for like medical research and that sort of thing. The ocean has a microbiome too. It's made up a lot of the similar things, bacteria, archaea, a lot of the things that are in those images, the tiny giants images, and it's really important to how the ocean functions and things like the health of the ocean. And so I'll go through a few examples showing some of the images, some more images that, you know, wouldn't quite make the cut of the tiny giants, but they show some interesting things, I think. But aesthetically, they're maybe not quite as beautiful. And just to give you an idea of how the ocean microbiome works. So this is an image that's part of tiny giants. These are three diatoms. It's a single-celled phytoplankton, which is the plant. Most of the plant life in the ocean are these tiny single cells. The reason it looks kind of metallic is partly because it's an electron scanning microscope image, which usually coats the cell before it images it with electrons, but also because the outer casing of these cells is made of glass. The organisms pull silicate out of the water around them to build these glass shells that they live in. And the reason I put oxygen production at the top is because the ocean microbiome, cells like these that photosynthesize, just like land plants photosynthesize, they're producing oxygen. And in fact, they produce half of the oxygen that we breathe in this sort of the global atmosphere comes from the ocean microbiome. And to put that into some perspective, one thing I think is really interesting about the way these microbes and single-celled organisms produce oxygen, if you were to go back in time a little over 2 billion years on the Earth, there's life here, but the atmosphere would be poisonous to us, basically because there's not enough oxygen. The reason we have levels of oxygen and then all this oxygen-utilizing life on the planet is because microbes started photosynthesizing and producing oxygen as a byproduct, and there's this big oxygen explosion, not literally an explosion, but a geological time scales an explosion of oxygen, and that led to the evolution of the, you know, what we call higher forms of life. So they play this critical role in sort of the regulating the ecosystem in terms of the air we breathe and that sort of thing, and all kinds of other functions like that. Clean drinking water is another example. They regulate climate. This is the one image I took. I think it's kind of like the worst one of all of them. But nobody else looks at gelatinous organisms, which is what this is. This is called a cell. And the reason I have climate regulation up there, so you've probably heard about climate change and extra carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, largely carbon-based, going into the atmosphere, heating up the heating the climate and how, yeah.
When you say a word like the name of this guy that many of us may not be familiar with, could you say it a little slower, maybe you spell it?
Sure, SALP, S-A-L-P.
Oh, okay.
It's like, if you try to type it, your spell check will write slap. I just saw a bunch of slaps washing up on the shore. I have this whole citizen science reporting network to look for jellyfish on the shore. So by the way, if you see any jellyfish, this is technically not a jellyfish, but people will see gobs of them and think it is, and in some ways it acts similar to them. So people will email me, like, I just saw a bunch of slaps. I think they might be slaps. But anyway, if you see jellyfish, you can email me at jellyfish@bigelow.org, and I use like a citizen reporting network to track jellyfish blooms in Maine. But that's an aside. So The reason that they're important for climate regulation is because all this extra carbon that we put into the atmosphere, the main way that that can be taken out is through the ocean microbiome. All of the single cells that are taking up carbon dioxide to, sort of their version of breathing in a way, to build the structure of their cells and so on, they can pull that carbon dioxide out into the ocean. And if it's going to be removed for a long period of time, it needs to be sort of gobbled up by one of these guys, and they're sort of like vacuum cleaners. They bloom really quickly, they scoop up all of the you can think of the ocean microbiome, they package it into dense deco pellets that sink to the bottom of the ocean. So you can think of it, it's called the ocean carbon pump. It's a way, one possible way of counteracting all of the excess carbon that we're putting into the atmosphere. Nature, in to some degree, can compensate for that through these natural climate regulation mechanisms. So there's almost like this natural homeostasis that exists within the global ecosystem, largely mediated through the ocean microbiome. Another neat example, this is not one of the tiny giants images, but I just wanted to include this because I think ocean viruses are really cool. What you're looking at is a cell, and inside the cell are all these little tiny dots. This is magnified a whole bunch of times. These are, it's really hard to get an image of marine viruses, but there's something like, I'm probably going to get this number wrong now. I just looked it up today to make sure I got it right. I think it's 10 million viruses in a drop of seawater. So if you've ever gone swimming in the ocean, well, who's ever gone swimming in the ocean? That's who hasn't. Because if you haven't, what are you doing here? If you've ever gone swimming in the ocean, you've swallowed millions upon billions of virus particles. And of course, they're not, we're all still here. They're not harmful to humans, but they play this this really complex and nuanced role in the ocean microbiome. So you think about all that carbon coming into the food web through photosynthesis and through this microbiome. Viruses can, they can cause population crashes. They can affect how much of that carbon sinks versus how much gets redirected into things like fish and whales and the other charismatic animals that we, we often think about when we imagine the ocean. So it sets up a really complex food web. And I also just, think the idea of swimming in a sea of viruses is pretty amazing. And this is, this is another pretty new area of research. 20 years ago, we didn't know, the extent to the prevalence of marine viruses throughout the ocean and their importance. Okay, so that was climate regulation. There's also an important role for the ocean microbiome in terms of ocean health. And I put health in quotations because there's kind of a human judgment that goes on there, like what is a healthy ocean? I think in some cases it's the difference between a healthy and an unhealthy ocean, it can be clear, but in other cases it really depends on what you're interested in. So it can be kind of weighted depending on your perspective. But there are a lot of issues surrounding ocean health right now. One example, which you might have heard of, is ocean acidification. So this is kind of the other CO2 problem that people talk about. A lot of that extra carbon that goes into the atmosphere, absorbed into the ocean, makes the seawater more acidic. And it's enough so that it affects shell-forming organisms, like these microscopic snails that you're looking at here. And it makes it basically so that they can't form their shells. The shells dissolve, or that it takes them a lot more resources in some cases to build the shells. So the ocean microbiome sort of, in some ways, is an indicator of ocean health. Some of the other issues that are out there so this is another image. I don't remember what species this is, but this is in tiny giants too. And if you track down the image, you can use those fancy iPhone things, which I don't know how they work. Another kind of way that ocean health is manifested through the microbiome is through something called eutrophication, where you have a lot of, it's usually from a lot of excess fertilizer runoff from, could just be like around the lakes in Maine, it could just be from people's properties, but if you think about the Gulf of Mexico dead zone, it's from kind of the Mississippi watershed washing all the fertilizer off. What happens is that fertilizer stimulates growth, phytoplankton growth, which is then grazed down mostly by bacteria, And that depletes all the oxygen in the water. You get these, they call them dead zones, or the, you know, fancy words are anoxic or hypoxic areas where other organisms can't live. And that's basically, you know, happens through the through this excess growth in the ocean microbiome. Another example is red tides, you might have heard of. And these are, again, mostly single-celled organisms in the ocean, and they have toxic effects that actually affect humans. So if they can be filtered through bivalves and affect you if you eat them. In some really bad cases, just breathing the toxins that come off of red tides can affect human health. So anyway, the ocean microbiome, really important, also really beautiful by some of these images. And there's an upside to human health as well. So I mentioned red tides, that's something that you have to watch out for, but there are ways that we can utilize the resources in the ocean microbiome to enhance human health. And so this isn't one of the tiny giants pictures either, but what this is showing is a little oyster parasite called Purkinsis, which it's a single-celled organism that affects oysters. Oyster farmers worry about it because it can wipe out the stock. But what's really neat about it is it's really closely related to the parasite that causes malaria in humans. And the advantages to this are, one, it's not dangerous to humans. It's really bad for oysters, but not to humans. And we can culture it in a lab. So there's actually a guy at Bigelow who cultures this oyster parasite to use it as a model for studying malaria and possible vaccines for malaria. And there are all kinds of other examples of, you know, medicines and pharmaceuticals that are kind of, sort of hidden in this, the sort of, I think of it as like the genetic code of the ocean microbiome, but there are all these sort of unknown and untapped resources, and a lot of them could have human health benefits. So that's another sort of dimension to the, you know, reasons that we study the ocean microbiome. And then lastly, just, you know, to go back to the beauty of it, these are some drawings from Ernst Haeckel, who was a naturalist in the 1800s, who is probably the first person to make, you know, the beauty in the ocean microbiome. They weren't calling it that at the time, but to make it kind of, to expose it to a general public, to a lay public. You know, at the time, like, science was this very sort of elite activity, and these images, these drawings that he did had a really wide distribution, and it, you know, that legacy lives on today. And that was just the name of the collection of those drawings, Art Forms of Nature. So that's kind of the ocean microbiome in a nutshell. I feel like I've been talking. That's what I'm here for, I guess. But I was going to shift to talking about, I need to do my little Bigelow plug. And so, like I said, Bigelow focuses on the ocean microbiome, and we're trying to understand all of those things that I just talked about. Some of the cool facilities that we have there, one of them is called the National Center for Marine Algae and Microbiota. It's basically a library. I think of it, these are my own words, but I think of it as the ocean microbiome library. We have all kinds of strains of single-celled organisms that live in the ocean that we culture. And, you know, these are used for scientific purposes. They're used to grow, aquaculture feed from, that sort of thing. They're used to do pharmaceutical research. So if someone is looking for a strain of some type of organism that lives in the ocean, they can come to this library and order some, and we maintain that. I think there are about 3,000 strains that we keep. That number might have changed. Another one is the Single Cell Genomic Center. This allows us to take those individual cells and map the entire genome. And so I think of it as like cracking the genetic code of the ocean. And we can use that both to understand all of those processes that I just explained, and the same sort of things that I've been talking about. Human health, ocean health, all of those things. By looking at the genetic code, it tells us what each organism could be doing, and that sort of thing. And then finally, we've just started these what are called Centers for Venture Research, where we're really focused on taking the kind of the fundamental knowledge that we're uncovering about the ocean microbiome and translating it to societal benefit. And I'll come back to that a little bit at the end when I talk about ways of adapting to climate change.